This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It sounds like a Victor Hugo plotline, maybe Les Mis. A poor woman, a mother, is sent away to prison, maybe for stealing something she thought she needed. And while she is in jail, her children are taken away forever, put up for adoption, gone. In fact, it's not a Broadway tearjerker, it's American law, and it's happening all the time. 15 months in foster care while mom's in jail for theft, for crack, and the kids are on the fast track to adoption. Prisoner rights advocates say it's double jeopardy and a travesty. Child welfare advocates say it's that or purgatory for the kids. Up next on Point, as America's female prison population soars, taking the kids. Joining me now from New York is Wall Street Journal reporter Lori Cohen. She put this story high in the public eye last week. Lori Cohen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what's driving this? What's the law say? What's required?
What the law says is that if your child has been in foster care for 15 of the last 22 months, that states must move to terminate your parental rights.
And that means adoption. That means foster care is no longer enough.
It means eventually adoption. I mean, the point is to get kids out of foster care and to get them adopted faster than the way it used to happen.
What's driving the numbers here, Lori? You're looking, or we're seeing the overall numbers of American women in prisons.
Well, I happen to look at the confluence of these two events. The women's prison population is rising at a much faster rate than that of the men. Obviously, there aren't as many women in prison as men, but it's just climbing at a faster rate. And so when the law went into effect, there were 70-odd thousand women in prison. Today, there are about 104,000 women in prison. And if they don't have a place to put their children when they get arrested or before they get arrested, then the children end up in foster care. And because sentences are getting longer and longer, a lot of women are facing termination of their parental rights.
So you've got a growing number of women in prison, longer sentences because of mandatory sentencing guidelines? Is that correct?
Well, there are two things that happened. One is that many states put into practice mandatory sentencing guidelines, particularly for drug crimes. And the other thing that happened is the federal sentencing guidelines got a lot stiffer, and whereas judges used to be able to look at women and say, okay, you're a single parent, I'm going to be lenient on you, they really can't do that anymore.
How often is this happening? I mean, you'd think that people would try to put their kids with grandma and granddad or with a sister or something. I mean, why make them, leave them vulnerable to being lost permanently?
Unfortunately, sometimes there isn't grandma or granddad in the picture for many women. Either they're here from another country, or grandma and granddad have their own criminal issues or problems or lack of funds, or they're not in touch. But there are about 30,000 kids right now in foster care because of parental incarceration.
Is this a global problem? What happens in other countries when mom goes to jail?
Well, very few countries move to terminate as quickly as the U.S. does, if at all. In fact, most countries don't even do that. But in many European countries in particular, young kids are allowed to spend time in prison with their mothers in special children's sections or children's housing, and the mothers can be mothers to their children while they're there. In other situations, communities pitch in and care for the children.
We read last week about American women prisoners giving birth to babies shackled in chains, effectively. Now this, I mean, what are the arguments here? I mean, on the surface, it can sound like a kind of a Les Mis situation. Steal a crust of bread, lose your kids forever. It can sound absolutely, you know, how can this punishment fit the crime? What's the argument for this?
Well, the argument for it is that kids shouldn't be held hostage to the fact that their parents are in prison. They really deserve a family situation and good care. And the other argument is that a lot of these women who are in prison, it's not their first time. It's their second, it's their third, it's their fourth time. They're recidivists, and there's no telling whether there's going to be another time afterward. And they get out, they have no housing, they have no jobs. They really have no means by which to take care of children. So, I mean, there is an argument in some quarters that it's really better for these children to be well cared for by other people who they can call mom and dad.
We're going to hear from a woman who lost her daughter in this way, but give us in brief the story of Tamika Davis. You wrote that up. What happened there?
Well, I met Tamika last summer when she was in jail in Buffalo, and really believed that she, you know, would be a great mom when she got out, that, you know, she'd been in jail before but seemed to have learned her lesson. She was
arrested for stealing men's jeans and shirts.
Well, she was arrested for shoplifting, yes. Well, what she pleaded guilty to was shoplifting. Mm-hmm. There was a little more involved. But anyway, mm-hmm. I really believed she would be fine when she got out and that, you know, she would be reunited with her children, even though they'd moved to terminate her rights. I really thought she would get out, find herself a job. But, you know, a lot of times, you know, just, you know, these women have grown up in very dysfunctional families and
yep.
don't know any better. And so she got out and had no place to live, really didn't know how to look for a job, and was rearrested 3 weeks later and is now out, you know, for shoplifting, and is now out again and on welfare and still trying to get her children back.
But at the moment, her daughter headed where? More likely toward adoption or back to her? Is it clear?
Unclear. You know, if Tamika can get her act together in the next few months and get a job and show that she can support these children, there's a chance that she'll get her son and daughter back. But if she can't, then she won't.
You've got this tear-jerking letter from her son. Mom, you have got to get yourself straight. I cannot wait until you get out of jail so we can start all over again.
Well,
you'll get a job. We can have a good life. You know I love you. Just try to be right in jail so you can have us back. I love you, Mom. I mean, this is wrenching.
It's heartrending. I mean, the real victims here obviously are the children
yeah.
because they didn't ask for their mothers to commit crimes, get caught, and be arrested. I mean, they just really are asking for their moms to be good moms and to care for them. And this is an 11-year-old boy who's really bonded with his mother, even though she's been incarcerated before, you know, has lived most of his life with her despite that, and, you know, wants her back.
But his dad serving a 100-year prison term for murder, the daughter's father died of gunshot wounds. I mean, it's a tough situation.
Yeah, these families are kind of dysfunctional to begin with, and they have all sorts of issues, and so that's why there are some family welfare advocates who just say, you know, give the kids to somebody else, let somebody else have a shot at them.
Lori Cohen, we thank you for raising the story. We thank you for being with us today.
I thank you.
Lori Cohen of the Wall Street Journal. We're talking this hour about American women going to prison and losing their children forever. Joining me now from New York is Tamar Kraft Stoller. She's director of the Correctional Association of New York's Women in Prison Project. It's a prison watchdog group in New York State. Tamar, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us from Philadelphia, Richard Gellis. He's director of the University of Pennsylvania's School of Social Policy and Practice. He helped write the 1997 Adoption and Safe Families Act. Mr. Gellis, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Tamar Kraft Stoller, first to you. How do you? We don't know where to put our heart here. The idea of a child being torn away forever, terrible. The idea of
right.
a child living endlessly in foster care drift, not pretty either. So how do you read this?
Right. Absolutely. It's a difficult dichotomy to deal with. But what we do have to realize is that ASFA really does have this unintended, terrible consequence on families. Families where parents are in prison do not really have a fighting chance to maintain relationships, to be together. So ASFA does not allow for an individualized assessment of where each family is, what the healthy development of that child that's in foster care should be. So there's no magic number. Of course we don't want children to languish in foster care. Everybody believes that children should have a safe and stable home. It's just at what cost? Are we unnecessarily terminating the rights of parents in prison simply because of shorter timelines that run up against longer sentences? And the answer to that is yes.
Richard Gellis, you helped write the Adoption and Safe Families Act along with Senator Mike DeWine, Ohio, and Casey Bevin, senior policy advisor to Tom DeLay. Is it working? Is it working the way you hoped, you intended?
Well, before I answer that, let's go back and look at some of the finer points of the law, because I think the law is about to be misinterpreted in this hour. First of all, the law said that when a child has been in out-of-home care for 15 of the previous 22 months, and that out-of-home care is not in kin care, not with relatives.
Not with grandma, not with a sister.
No. Mm-hmm. It has to be a non-kin.
Yeah, foster
care. The state
care.
Is obligated to seek a termination of parental rights.
Mm-hmm.
The state doesn't grant it, and it has to be granted by a judge. And the state is obligated to provide not... Mom doesn't have to prove she's fit. The state has to prove that she is unfit.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so not every petition to terminate parental rights, even for moms who are in jail, is agreed upon by a judge.
So there's some discernment here, but a lot of it's happening.
Now, wait. Mm-hmm. The state doesn't have to go forward, even at the 15 to 22 months rule, if it believes there are compelling interests that are in the best interest of the child not to seek a termination of parental rights. So it's really unfair to cast this law as must. The law is intended to move decision-making because what was happening was nothing was being done. If mom has a compelling case, if mom has appropriate legal representation, if it's in the best interest of the child, even though mom is in jail, the judge does not have to grant that termination of parental rights.
So there's room for discretion here. Those states
Absolutely.
Are financially incented to see this grow. $192 million in adoption incentives awarded since fiscal 98. Clearly, you think there are many reasons where this is exactly what should happen. Explain the dynamic to us.
Well, for one thing, let's go back to the Ms. Cohen's discussion. If you can't find an appropriate placement for your child when you're going to prison, this says a great deal about the support system that's in that child's life.
You don't have there's not a father there or another parent. There's not an extended family.
Not a grandfather, not an uncle, not a friend, not a next door neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And the research for 40 years has known that social isolation and the lack of support is a risk factor for continued child abuse and neglect. So that has to be considered. The second thing that has to be considered, and I have to say that these shows can never do justice to the children because you can't have a nine-month-old child on the show to talk about an attachment disorder that's occurring while the child's brain is
Our imaginations are pretty good. You lay it out. We'll listen.
Kids' brains hardwire between birth and 18 months. The child's development from there on is really dependent upon having an adult who's there for that child in an unconditional relationship. That does not happen in foster care.
California's been looking recently at letting those children stay with their mothers or be near their mothers for the first 18 months at least. What about that as opposed to taking them away?
I mean, I think that the prison system wants to keep a relationship alive with a mother and a child. There's nothing wrong with that. What is wrong is unrealistically, by apathy and by unwillingness to make a tough decision, to hold the child's development hostage in the hope that mom will put together a network of social support, mom will get a job, mom will give up her drug pattern, mom will give up stealing. I mean, that's an awful lot to ask. Smokers who are simply addicted to smoking, 80% cannot quit smoking in 18 months.
And yet giving up children is a lot to ask as well, and we haven't traditionally seen that as sort of part of the package when someone goes to prison. I want to bring in someone who's been through exactly this. Deetra Welch joins us. She's 37 years old, began using crack at 16, sent to prison in 1999 for possession of crack cocaine with intent to sell. Her third prison term in 7 years. Her daughter, Gwen, was born in 1999, placed in foster care. In 2002, Gwen was adopted. Deetra says she's been clean since 1999, but she doesn't have her daughter back. Deetra Welch, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
How did this happen? Why did it happen?
I don't understand it myself. I did everything they asked me to do. I got a job. I went back to school. And the judge still claimed that it was just too much history. They claimed that she didn't know me when they only gave me 1 hour out of a month to visit her.
When you were in prison, your daughter was in foster care. You were supposed to have regular visits with her. Did those happen?
No.
Why not?
They would call, they would cancel the visits and say that she couldn't come because she was sick. Then they would call, they would write and say she couldn't come because it was just too far. And I think it was an hour drive. But
this was the foster mother saying it's just too far, it's too much trouble, I'm not going to bring her by.
the caseworker brought her. It was the caseworker.
Mm-hmm. Even the caseworker said it was too far to bring her by.
Yes.
What are you doing now, Ms. Welch?
I work at Haymarket. I work on a mom's program for incarcerated pregnant women.
And do you know where your daughter Gwen is?
No.
What did the judge tell you when he decided that you would not ever get her back?
The judge told me that it was too much history, that she didn't know me. She didn't know who I was.
You have a couple of older children, so you're not a novice at this. What do you think about the judge's view? Was there too much history? Should you have Gwen back? Should you have?
Yes, I feel I should have her back. I'm a mother. And Gwen, I feel I should have her back. Gwen has two sisters and a brother that she don't even know. And I believe people can change. And you telling me that now I did everything that you asked me to do. You know, if you wouldn't have asked me to do it, I was ready to get my life together anyway when I hold my baby in my arms. I knew when I hold her that I was ready to raise my child.
The appellate court panel said that there had been, quoting here, substantial progress in your case toward correcting your life as you sought to regain custody of the child, but the judge said too much history. Where's justice here, Dietra Welch? I mean, you must have seen some parents who just aren't taking good care of their kids. Where do you see the balance between the child's interest and the parent or family interest?
I don't. I wanted to respond to something he said. My mother was going to get my daughter, my oldest sister, the father's mother, and they wouldn't give it to her.
Because?
Because my mother was in Milwaukee.
Which was out of state, so that Gwen couldn't go? Mm-hmm.
And the father's mother stayed in Minnesota.
So your daughter couldn't go to an extended family. Richard Gellis, what do you make of Dietra Welch's story? She wanted her daughter. She wants her now. That daughter's gone.
Well, you know, we have Ms. Welch on the phone, and I don't have the whole case in front of me. Let me go back to the law. The law says that the state is obligated to make reasonable efforts to keep a child with a mother, even if the mother is in jail. There's not a pass on that if the mom is in jail.
But that did not happen in this case, we're told.
It may well be that this is a case of a tremendous injustice. And the tremendous injustice does not make the law bad. It makes this case bad. And Ms. Welch may have had really poor representation, but if it's a case that already went to an appellate court and the state satisfied its requirements for reasonable efforts, I think there may not have been a miscarriage of justice.
And Tamara Kreftstoller, what do you hear? Mm. Is it bad law, or is this just an unfortunate situation where Dietra Welch got the short end of the stick in a big way?
Right. Well, when adhering to the letter of the law and the reasonable efforts, when that's the exception rather than the rule, you know that something wrong is happening. And
who says it's the exception rather than the rule?
Well, there's a recent government study that showed that mothers in prison, one half of mothers in prison across the country, have never had a visit with their children. So in New York State, and as Dr. Gels mentioned, across the country, there are foster care agencies are under legal obligations to bring children in their care to visit parents in prison. This often does not happen. It often doesn't happen because of the distance between where the child is living and where the parent is incarcerated. It doesn't happen because there isn't appropriate training and resources for caseworkers to take the children to the prison. It doesn't happen because of correctional policies that make visiting difficult and uncomfortable. I also want to go back to this phrase we keep using, holding children's development hostage. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really taken out of context, because when you really take a look at the facts and what holds children's development hostage, it's being separated from their parents. Children of incarcerated parents suffer from elevated levels of depression, anxiety. There's stigma associated with it.
But they're separated for a reason. Their parents committed a crime. I mean, we accept that we put criminals in prison sometimes.
We need to distinguish between bad parenting and bad decisions. And when we mush the two together, We do it at the great detriment of families. So whether the mother has made a mistake, does the mistake negate motherhood? Of course it doesn't. Does the child still have a right to have a relationship with their parent? Of course they do. And the children that we, children of incarcerated parents that my agency works with, say this all the time. My mother made a mistake, but I still love her. I don't want to be adopted. I still want to have a relationship.
Deidre Welch,
too often, children's rights to have a relationship are not played out.
Deidre Welch, you've said that you feel as though you were put in double jeopardy here, that you were punished twice for your crimes by losing your daughter, Gwen. Is that right?
Yes, because I served the time for the crime that I committed. I served my time. They set the system up to rehabilitate you. I feel I was rehabilitated. And recovered, I'm going to be recovering for the rest of my life as a recovering addict. But to take my child after I served the time and I done changed my life, I don't have any more crime. I haven't committed any more crimes. Mm-hmm. I don't have any intention on committing any more crimes. I have the best support system in the world behind me. I have been blessed, and I am thankful, but I want my child. I still miss my child. They took a part of me. I love my child. Just because I committed a crime don't mean I don't love my kids.
I want to bring our callers into this conversation. There are many who want to join. Tony's calling from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm an adoptive mother of a child who was in and out of foster care from the age of 6 weeks till she started to live with us at age five.
Was the mother or father in prison, or is that not the issue here?
Her mother was in and out of jail. She was in jail for shoplifting the first time my daughter went into foster care at age 6 weeks.
So what do you think about all this, Tony?
You know, in spite of my daughter's history, I think that the parents need to be given many more opportunities than the 15 months out of 22 and they lose their kids. I think the law isn't really enacted for the purpose that people state. I think it's there to fix the foster care problems, not the parent problems. And I think that if resources were poured into ensuring the safety of kids, making sure caseworkers didn't have to supervise so many cases, because what happens is you get some horrific cases of abuse while kids are in foster care, and then it's, let's get them all out of foster care and get them adopted as quickly as possible. And although our daughter is very happy now, it's been a long road for her to get over the fact that her mother's parental rights were terminated. And her mother was given lots of chances, and I have no regrets that her rights were terminated. But for every person like her who doesn't make it, there are ones who could, and that biological bond is so strong.
Tony, stick with us. Richard Gellis, here's the complaint that it's foster care system problems being fixed or patched at the expense of parental and family rights. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, when we wrote the law was designed to ensure that kids would have permanence. Now, the federal government and the states combined to spend $20 billion on the foster care system, and I'll be the first to admit that it is completely dysfunctional. But a law can't make the child welfare system functional. This law was designed to try to create some kind of level playing field between a child's needs and a child's rights and a parent's needs and a parent's rights.
Mm-hmm.
And the foster care system has, in fact, created the problem. They do too little and they do it too late. And we wanted to put the foster care system in a situation where they at least had to make the decision with a child's sense of time.
Because children don't have forever. They only grow up once.
Their brains only wire once. They don't get their brains to recycle when mom is let out of prison. Their brains rewire once. They need permanence once. And I do use the term children's development held hostage, because once you go into foster care, the likelihood of you being abused doesn't go up, it goes down. The abuse rate of kids in foster care is actually half of what it is among kids who are reunified with moms and dads who haven't actually changed their behavior. So there are lots of reasons to argue why permanence and permanence early is in a child's best interest.
Tony, thanks for your call from Tampa. Let me get a call from Dracut, Massachusetts. Jeff is on the line. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? I like your program very much.
Thank you, Jeff.
My question is, I'm a police officer, and there are many times you said that the one woman said that the daughter, the child that she adopted, was taken from a woman who was shoplifting.
Yes.
And as a police officer, I can seriously say that most shoplifters have drug habits, and they have very serious drug habits. And one of the encounters that we have up here in Massachusetts is the OxyContin issue,
right,
the heroin addiction. And a lot of times, those issues, they're not, you can rehabilitate somebody, but they're never really rehabilitated.
Do you have kids, because, Jeff? Do you have kids yourself?
Yes, I have a little boy.
And if you had an OxyContin problem, do you think you should lose your son?
Well, I think that obviously the laws need to be tweaked a little bit, and they're not perfect. But if I'm not able to take care of my son properly, then yes, I honestly have to say that somebody should come and take him.
Yep.
Because I don't think it's fair to the child. I think that if you can give that child to somebody who is a good parent,
mm-hmm,
who is a very sane individual that can make good decisions,
mm-hmm,
who's not going to put them in a car where they're not, just to say, in their seat, car seat properly, or
to say the least.
Yeah, to speed down the road, or to not be conscious of other people, you know, in their surroundings. I think that that is probably the most important thing.
Jeff, thank you very much for your call. Dietra Welch, how about it? You see a lot of women who have criminal histories at Haymarket there in Chicago. What about Jeff's point? There are people who just don't take care of their kids, in prison or out, and it's a punishment to the kids to leave them in that situation.
You're right. It is, but I'm not one of those parents, and everybody isn't the same. And some people just do what they know they need to be educated.
Mm-hmm.
They're not setting it up to where they're educating them on their drug habits. They're not educating them on how to raise their child or anything. Some people need help.
And they're not getting it tomorrow. Is this in a way a kind of pressure valve? I mean, instead of looking at individual cases, instead of fixing social problems, we just take the kids away? Is this an easy way to address social problems?
It's an easy way, and it's an incredibly detrimental way. I think we need to talk about really what population of people we really are talking about. This is a punishment for poor people. The vast majority of kids who are in foster care are from families that live in poor communities. The vast majority of people in prison are from poor communities of color. So instead of front-loading services to families that are suffering because they're living in poverty, suffer from incredibly high rates of drug addiction, instead of front-loading services to them, we have these back-end punishments. We have collateral consequences that come with having a felony conviction. Our incarceration policies, our child welfare policies, they're not front-end solutions. They don't actually address the social and economic problems that drive crime. Instead, they punish people.
Right now, Penny's calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hi, Penny. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to make the point that I am a foster parent. I work with birth families, adoptive families, and children in residential care, and I also teach PS math.
So you know a lot about it. What do you see?
Well, for one, I think the idea that taking children and just all of a sudden they're disappearing from parents when they go to prison is not quite accurate. And I also agree with Richard Gellis that, mm-hmm, if a child's not able to find permanency and they're not able to establish a safe and stable relationship and attachment, they're not going to be able to continue on their development, which is, you know, important in all areas, education, their moral development, their spiritual development.
And what about that core connection to the biological parent? Do you think we put too much weight on that? Is it more important to get them into a long-term, stable, adopted family away from that parent?
I think in any way that there can be permanency is important. If a child, but one of the points that hasn't been made is that,
mm-hmm,
children who are adopted are able to maintain connection with their birth families if it's safe. And there are many adoptive families that are willing to do that.
Dietra Welch, have you been able to maintain contact with your daughter, Gwen?
No, I don't even know who has Gwen. And I'm trying to figure out, how do they choose then? How do you pick which one? They never even came out to see my house. So how do you pick which one who they should snatch the parental rights from and the one who should keep them?
Penny, do you have an answer to that? You know, Dietra, this is her daughter. She says don't use too blunt an instrument to decide here. How do you decide effectively? She feels like the details of her case were overlooked.
Well, certainly I think the point was brought up that, you know, there's a case-by-case, you know, basis which the law has to look at and the judges have to look at. And at 15 months, like Richard Gullis was saying, you don't have to terminate rights, but permanency hearings are required to review those cases. And I think that, for example, in her case, she was saying her support system was living out of state.
Right.
But a home study would have to be done with extended family. So, you know, all those types of things would have had to or should have been taken into account when making a decision.
Or should have. But it's quite a relationship to break up, and yet there's the child's welfare issue. Penny, thanks for calling. Let me get a call from Bob in Canton, Massachusetts. Hi, Bob. What do you think?
I want to weigh in saying that I think far too much weight is placed upon parental rights. There's only one chance to raise a kid. If you mess up, it should be over.
You know something firsthand about this, Bob?
Yes. A long time ago, I went through the process in a nearby state many, many years ago.
As a foster kid?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And my siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother's rights were retained to the point where adoption was precluded, and not necessarily for good reasons. It was a long process that hurt. It hurt a lot.
And you would have been happier if, I mean, it's not a happy situation, but it would have been better if you'd been adopted somewhere permanent earlier.
I firmly believe that.
Bob, we cannot ignore that. Tamar Kraft-Stoller, what do you say to Bob? He's been through this, and you see his conclusion.
Right. Absolutely. And this is why it really comes down to an individualized assessment. But again, when you look at the vast majority of cases of incarcerated parents, caseworkers are not able to make that individualized assessment. The compelling reason exception does not play out the same in the lives of incarcerated parents. We also have to recognize the man who was on the phone said, when you mess up, it should be over. We have to take a look at who's quote-unquote mess up. When somebody who is rich, who is white, has a substance abuse problem and is able to make it into a program, it's not over for them. We're talking about when poor people, mainly poor people of color, mess up, it's over for them. So we really need to reevaluate the lens through which we look at these policies and also recognize that the specific circumstances of incarcerated parents do not make for what should be an individualized assessment by caseworkers. Instead, ASFA does become this blunt instrument.
Richard Gullis, what do you say to that? I'm looking here in an interview you did where you say that the children are, quote, almost always going to be from poor families, from minority families, from Spanish-speaking or non-majority language families. Is this a kind of punishment for being poor?
Well, the child welfare system is hardly race-blind and income-blind. It really is a system where if you're poor and if you're a minority, you're much more likely to be caught up in the system. And I'm going to agree with Tamara, but it's another discussion. The other discussion is, what does this society owe to its citizens and its children in terms of meeting basic needs? We're not, when we were writing ASTRA, capable of going back to 1972 and trying to enact the Comprehensive Child Development Bill. We had that opportunity in 1972, and President Nixon vetoed it. We're left with a society that only wants to do residual social policies. I'm a dean of a school of social work.
Right.
And I'm hardly a conservative, and hardly not sympathetic to this argument. However, you have to deal with the cards you dealt with. And the cards we're dealt with is a system where, you know, the threshold of taking a child out of a home is a very high one to meet.
Sure is.
There are 3 million reports of child abuse in this country every year. Of those 3 million reports that are investigated, 100,000 children are removed. So the likelihood of having your child removed, whether you're poor or whether you're a person of color, is not very high to begin with. From that number, then the threshold for having a termination of parental rights is even higher. The state has to prove with significant evidence that you are unfit and inadequate. Now, if the state at the same time is not meeting its obligations to help the parents as it may well have not in Dietrich's case, the corrective action is a class action suit. And Tamara knows this because in New York, New York's ACS was taking kids away from their moms because the moms were in the hospital because they were victims of domestic violence. And in the class action Nicholson suit, they brought it into federal court and says, no, you can't do this. You're denying the mothers constitutional rights to due process. And the judge said to ACS, under no circumstances are you to take children from their moms simply because the moms are victims of domestic violence. If there's an injustice against women in prison, the injustice has to be rectified by such a class action suit. If states are not meeting their obligations to get kids to see their moms, to support their moms, we're not going to go back and rewrite ASFA for that. You have to do that on the platform where it ought to be debated.
Dieter Welch, let me ask you. You were on crack. Your daughter was born addicted, Gwen. So there's a very personal side of this, where, and I hear you taking some responsibility for that.
Yeah.
But where do you come down on this? Do you see this as a personal failing? Do you see this as, on the other hand, racial injustice?
You know, I believe it's both. He just said to himself, if I had a better lawyer, well, I can only afford a public defender. At the time, I could only afford a public defender. Mm-hmm. And I believe she fought, she did the best she could.
And still, here's what you're left with.
And this is what I'm left with.
John's calling from Amherst, New York. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Thank you once again for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
I'm not unsympathetic to the plight of your guest, but I have to really cite what Richard said. Very conspicuously absent from this conversation are the fathers.
Yeah.
If there was a functional way for these children who are taken away from the moms because they're in prison, I have no problem with that. I come from old school where there actually was there were repercussions for your bad actions. I'll guarantee you that if, in fact, a woman knows that, okay, if you do act in this behavior, you're going to have your kid taken away, we will have less of it. We are erring on the side of protecting the parents' rights on the premise of if or if not, they will rehabilitate themselves at the expense of the child. And I just don't understand this. I, for the life of me, do not understand this conversation at all. People should have to pay for their bad actions. And there's nothing wrong with that. Believe me. I mean, I think most people really believe that.
John, we got it. And Tamar Craftola, here's just another definition of justice. John says, come on, where are the fathers here? Why aren't they taking care of these kids? Parents go off the rails and think there are no consequences for it? How do you respond?
Right. Well, there are three main points to make in response to that comment. One is that nobody's arguing that there shouldn't be consequences for illegal actions. There absolutely should be. What we're talking about are what should those consequences be, and that these are inappropriate consequences, collateral consequences of actually serving time for a crime. The second is that there's a gender dynamic to ASFA, at least in New York, and I think this is echoed across the nation. There's a recent study of incarcerated parents. Almost 90% of the incarcerated fathers said that their children were living with mothers, whereas the corresponding figure for mothers was about 20%. 18% of incarcerated mothers in New York State said that their children were living in non-kinship foster care. The corresponding figure for incarcerated fathers was less than 1%. So we see that not only does ASFA have a disproportionate impact on incarcerated parents, but that there's really a disproportionate impact on incarcerated mothers. So that's why we are focused on incarcerated mothers. It absolutely affects fathers as well.
Dietrich,
but I also want to address Dr. Gels's point, which is that there are other ways to address this problem. We don't have to go back and rewrite the entire Adoption and Safe Families Act law. We can, though, provide exceptions for incarcerated parents, which some states actually do. Nebraska, New Mexico, Colorado provide an exception for incarcerated parents if their child is in foster care for 15 out of the last 22 months for circumstances beyond the parent's control, such as incarceration. New York does not have this, and this is something that we're advocating for.
Dieter Welch, do you think you'll ever see your daughter Gwen again?
No, I don't.
What do you tell women in prison or who you fear could end up there about the risk that they're taking with that life?
I try to educate them on it. I try to let them know what can happen and I let them know what happened to me. I let them know what they can do to them, and is it really worth losing your kids, or what? They have to decide. They have to weigh it now. And I wanted to respond to what John said, that they believe that they should pay, but how long do he think they should pay for it?
How long is a big question. Weigh it now is the advice. Dieter Welch at the Haymarket Center in Chicago, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Richard Gelles at the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Policy and Practice. Richard Gelles, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Tamara Kraft Stoller at the Women in Prison Project in New York State. Thank you very much for joining us.
That's right, the Correctional Association of New York's Women in Prison Project. Thank you.
In full. Thanks a lot. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.